Let's get started. I'm Richard Baer, and this is Natural Resources 407, Religion, Ethics, and the Environment. Welcome. I want to introduce the two TAs to the course, and Rob, you arrived just in time. I'll introduce Greg Heitzus first. Greg, if you'll stand up a minute, is going to be one of the TAs. Actually is a Cornell undergraduate, went on to do a three-year master's degree at Yale in religion and forestry. He's been interested in environmental ethics for many years, and then has come back here to do a PhD in environmental ethics. Passed his general exam by June, Greg has worked for the course now for several years, and we're very happy to have him again this year. Rob, I had meant to get a little biographical detail on you ahead of time, so I'm going to let you stand up and introduce yourself.
Hi. I'm Rob Young. I'm a PhD student in natural resources. In my dissertation on urban ecology, I took a course with Professor Baer going on 15 years ago, I think. I still have the paper that I wrote. And I liked it better than you did. That's okay.
You're smarter than I was.
Well,
what's that
back then? Thanks,
Rob. And this is a rather momentous occasion for me. It's the last year I'm teaching before retirement. I must say that there's a little bit of bittersweet involved because teaching this course has been an enormous pleasure over the years, in part because you all have taught me a great deal. I learned an enormous amount over the years from my undergraduate and graduate students, and for me at least, it's what has made Cornell so much fun, is the kind of ongoing dialogue with students. And so I am a bit sad to start the last year. It's conceivable that I might teach a single course after retirement occasionally, but that's not at all clear. At any rate, it's a delight to start a new year and to have the opportunity to think together about some very interesting issues having to do with how we treat our natural environment and drawing into the discussion really a whole range of issues that have to do with how we understand ourselves. Because one of the central theses of the course will be that much of the way in which we treat the environment has to do with how we understand ourselves and with some of the goals and objectives we have, some of the shortcomings and so on. Much of our exploitation of nature, I believe, comes out of our own insecurity. This will be one of the central theses of the course. Just like we typically exploit each other out of our own insecurity. When we feel really good about ourselves, when life is going well, when we feel secure, we seldom feel the need to beat up on each other. It's when we feel insecure, when we feel we haven't gotten our fair share, when we're unsure about ourselves, that we more often act badly. And we're going to look at some of the ways in which that probably also affects our treatment of animals, our treatment of nature, in the natural environment more broadly. And it's one of the reasons the course is really fun to teach, because we talk about a great variety of issues. I'm rather opinionated on some subjects, I'll warn you ahead of time. I delight in good argument just as much as in a good game of tennis. I want you to argue back and disagree when you think I'm off base or wrong about some issue. And that's, again, part of what I think university education at its best ought to be. We've become almost too politically correct, too worried that we're going to offend someone, too hesitant about saying what we really think on various issues. And that, in my judgment, often shortchanges the whole learning process and takes some of the fundamental dynamic out of a democratic pluralistic society. It's good that people come from different backgrounds and have different gifts and skills, because that's how we learn from each other. You know, as human beings, we're very strange creatures. We, for instance, not only live our lives as plants and animals do, but we constantly ask the question, how ought we to live our lives? What's the right thing to do, the good thing to do? Now, it's possible that a few other animals ask such questions of themselves. It's possible that mountain gorillas, maybe dolphins, elephants, ask questions about how they ought to live, but the evidence is very, very slim. It's not to say that animals don't think. We have quite a bit of evidence, obviously. Animals think in many different ways, and animals also far exceed us in various skills. Look at the radar-type capabilities or sonar-type capabilities of the bat. Look at the speed of the diving hawk, the age of the redwood trees, and so on. Animals far exceed us in many ways, but we have almost no evidence that they think philosophically and morally about how they ought to live their lives. In some ways, that's a great advantage to them. You know, we often torture ourselves with questions, how ought I to live? What's the right thing to do? It's probably why, as human beings, we have sometimes been described as the chattering species. We're constantly chattering. And in part, I think that's clearly because, much less so than most animals, if not all animals, we live by culture rather than just by genetic endowment. We decide how to live in many ways. We ask, what's the best life, what's the good life look like? And as far back as we have language, written language, and any record of the human condition, humans are asking the question, how should I live? I'm not claiming that humans are superior to animals in every way. That would be foolish, but we certainly are different from animals in that we ask these religious and philosophical and moral questions all the time. And as I've indicated, to some extent, that's a disadvantage. It makes life more difficult for us. And it's very difficult for us to really be very objective about some of these questions, although I think we constantly need to try. The late theologian Emil Brunner pointed out that if you take, say, math at one end of a spectrum, it's not, this is E. Emil Brunner, it's not all that difficult to be objective about math, because math as such doesn't have a whole lot to say about how you live with your children or roommates or a spouse or friend. Math is pretty abstract. Physics is not terribly hard to be objective. As you get to chemistry, it changes a little more. Physics already has something to do with how you move your arms and so on. Chemistry has to do with upset stomachs and all kinds of things that affect us personally. It has to do with our moods and attitudes. But then as you go over, say, from chemistry maybe to psychology, to sociology, maybe to history, literature, and come over far further to philosophy, maybe religion, and ethics. At this end of the spectrum, or the continuum, it's much harder to be objective. Because here, the answers you arrive at directly affect how you live. If you see this as a just way of living, but you're living quite differently, that produces a certain moral and cognitive dissonance. Soren Kierkegaard, the great Danish philosopher, pointed out, for instance, that the opposite of faith often is not doubt or unbelief, it's often disobedience. And what he was thinking of was something like this. You recognize a fairly high moral claim that you ought to live justly, that you ought to not engage in racism and economic injustice, you ought not to gossip about your neighbor, and so on. And that's a fairly high moral claim. But your life is down at this level. You're not living that way. You're living rather self-centeredly. And Kierkegaard says there are two possibilities. This is fairly obvious. You can bring your life up to the level of your moral claim, or you can bring your moral claim down to the level of your life. You say you no longer believe the moral claim because that's more comfortable. But what really has happened is not that you, for good reasons, came to doubt the moral claim, but you were uncomfortable with the dissonance, so you rationalized the claim and brought it down to the level of where you're living. I think that analysis is a profound analysis. Interestingly, it took place long before Freud, who talked about rationalization and the unconscious and so on. So it begins to be harder and harder to be objective and to really seek the truth dispassionately as we get over towards the right end of the spectrum, towards fields like philosophy, religion, and ethics. And that's both the fun of a course like this and also the difficulty, because we often don't really know exactly why we believe what we do, and sometimes in our more honest moments we discover we believe or disbelieve certain things for the wrong reasons. And we'll look at issues like that in some detail. It's also a wonderfully interesting set of issues because we live in an extraordinary world today. Of course, people already, when we learn to control fire as humans, when we learn to smelt metals, when we learned how to build ships and so on, had fears about the future. Already back in ancient Greece and other ancient civilizations over 2,000-3,000 years ago, people had a sense of foreboding about what technology could do. But I think what we have witnessed in the past 50 years, 70 years, truly does bring us into a new world. Nuclear bombs, bioengineering, the possibility of nanotechnology, robotics, and so on, mean that we live in an extraordinarily dangerous world. And our treatment of the environment becomes more and more critical. Bill Joy, in an article back in April of 2000 in Wired magazine, speculated that the conjunction of nanotechnology, robotics, and bioengineering under the larger umbrella of computers might very well make it possible within the next 10, 20, 30 years or so for one angry person to make the doomsday weapon, to interfere with a fundamental biological code at some point or another that would gradually move us all towards some kind of gray soup destruction. What interests me, and I'm not personally competent to evaluate his arguments, is that quite a few Nobel laureates and other scientists who know these fields well said, you know, you're really asking the right questions, alerting us to the right things. Joy asks the question, is it possible that some forms of knowledge are becoming so dangerous that we might deliberately decide not to gain them because if they fell in the hands of mentally unstable people or people with evil intent, that we might all be in huge danger? This is a strange and wonderful world. It's a very wonderful time, and a scary time to be a student in many of these fields. One of the reasons I wish I had another 50 years or so to live is you want to see how it all comes out. But there are tough issues. They're very, very difficult issues. And I think it's easy in such a world to become pessimistic and to give up hope, or to simply refuse to think about the issues, that we sense they're such big issues that we feel that we really can't make a difference anyway. I, of course, hope that that does not happen for us societally or as individuals, because I think there is something deep within us as human beings that does want to discover more about the good life. Aristotle talked about eudaimonia, what it means to flourish as a human being. There is something in us very deep that I believe is committed to fairness and does want to be hopeful about the future. I can remember almost as if it were yesterday a lecture that I attended over 50 years ago, just about 50 years ago. No, it wasn't quite. It had been about 48 years ago in Tübingen, Germany, as a graduate student in philosophy at the university there. And I began to be interested in some of the lectures that Professor Helmut Thielicke was giving in the area of ethics and theology. I had gone to study philosophy, but his lectures were so interesting that I increasingly began to sit in on them. And one day he announced that on the following week he would lecture on the subject of the theologische Bedeutung des Ballets, the theological significance of the ballet. And I thought, wow, that's what can one possibly say on that subject? And that sort of hooked me, and I decided I would attend. And it was a remarkable lecture. I'll, in just a couple minutes, get to summarize the heart of it. He argued that one of the interesting things about dance, ballet and various forms of modern dance and other dance, is that you try to create a certain kind of illusion. The reality is that there's gravity, there's fatigue, there's stiffness, the bones and muscles and torso don't always cooperate just like you would like them to do. It takes years and years of hard labor, of discipline, of dedication to become a first-rate dancer. And yet, what the dancer tries to do in various ways is to create the illusion that this is all somehow free and spontaneous, that one just is this way. The floor isn't what holds you up. It's just a kind of point of reference towards which you make an occasional pass. There's no gravity. It's light and airy. And this is an illusion, obviously. It's an illusion, however, of a very interesting sort, because occasionally, not often, but occasionally with really great dancers, the illusion almost becomes reality. People speak of those memorable events in dance and the ballet and so on when the dancer seems to be almost inspired, where she dances that way, he dances that way, because it seems like that's just the way they are. And it seems like they've broken through gravity and fatigue and all the discipline and just have learned to be this way. And it touches something very, very deep within us, I believe, as human beings, as dance has done for as long as we know historically. And Thielicke went on to suggest that probably part of the fascination and intrigue of the dance, in this case, is that it somehow reflects something very deep in us as human beings. He uses the two words in German, sein and sollen. Sein means being, what is, the reality. Sollen means what ought to be, what the ideal would be. And Thielicke says, you know, the being of human existence is that we're selfish and self-centered and often neglect justice and don't give a damn in a way about the well-being of our neighbor.
But most of us have a dream, just like Martin Luther King had a dream of what might be. That we don't have to live in a racist way that puts one people down and elevates another. We have a dream of justice and what it would mean to live more generously. And that much of human life is the tension between the sein and sollen, between the being and the oughtness. And just as in the dance, there are times when the illusion almost becomes reality. We do have those great figures in history, those St. Francis's of Assisi and many figures throughout the centuries who somehow have begun to live differently. And they become role models for us. We hold them up as people to emulate. Because in these people, at least at times, it seems that they really have been transformed. Something has happened that makes it possible for them to live more justly, more generously. And I think a great deal of why art and a great deal of dance and so on is so attractive is it calls to mind those kinds of tensions and possibilities. It's one reason I'm delighted that after many years in the wasteland, modern art is beginning to talk about beauty again and beginning to talk about the ideal again. It's like we spent enough decades in the garbage dump and it's time to recover something of that perennial function of great art and great literature. And in a way, this is why in this course we're not just going to talk about rules and regulations and philosophical analyses. We're going to look to some extent at religion and literature and art and try to raise some of these bigger questions about what life is about and how that affects our treatment of nature. Religion has been the source of great evil at times. People have killed in the name of religion, although it's a sobering realization that in the century just ended, probably more people were incarcerated, killed, and imprisoned in the name of atheism than in all the previous centuries in the name of religion. We still talk much about the Salem witch trials or the Inquisition or the wars of religion, but it's very sobering that probably at least 50 to 100 million people in the last century died out of an atheistic philosophy, which shows us, I think, that it's not religion or non-religion, it's the kind of fanaticism that can infect any one of us, whatever our beliefs, and lead us towards injustice and oppression. I heard a talk some years ago by former president of Cornell, Frank Rhodes. He quoted the lines, "Dust we may be, but the dust of a star and troubled by dreams." I love that. Dust we may be, but the dust of a star and troubled by dreams. Somehow nicely captures part of what it means to be human. The glory and the agony and the ecstasy, whatever. And we're going to look at some of those issues. We're going to ask again and again, who are we? What does it mean to be a human being? What is nature? Nature is one of the most complex terms in the language. The Oxford English Dictionary lists about 15 different meanings for nature and about 18 different meanings for natural. A very complex term. We'll spend a lecture or two on that subject. Are we a part of nature? Are we fully a part of nature? If we're fully a part of nature, does that mean that pollution is natural or unnatural? How could it be unnatural if it's fully a part of nature? And so on and on. We're going to ask some wonderful questions What is the nature of moral judgments? What are we saying when we say something is right or wrong or good or bad? What does it mean to know something, for instance, in science? Or can you have moral knowledge as well as scientific knowledge? One of the things I've observed in myself over the years is I am far less comfortable today using terms like certainly, without a doubt, no question about this, surely, than I was 30, 40 years ago. Not that I've become a nihilist or a relativist. I still believe there are moral absolutes. But it's not always as clear to me that our knowledge of exactly what they are is as reliable as it might be. Well, we'll talk more about that. It's a wonderful issue. Is there some middle ground between nihilism on the one hand and a kind of absolutism on the other? I want to just wind up this morning's lecture and then take about 5 minutes at the end. We have a few housekeeping details for sections and so on. By calling to mind a wonderfully interesting argument that was made over 50 years ago by C.S. Lewis in his little book, The Abolition of Man. This book was written back in 1947, over 50 years ago. And it's a remarkable book, in part because it really is prophetic. This was before bioengineering, before our knowledge of DNA and RNA and all the changes we've seen in the last 20, 30 years. He was aware of nuclear bombs, but there had been far fewer developments in the area of molecular biology and so on. And Lewis, in this little book, asks a very, very important question. What does it mean that human beings, he uses the term man, what does it mean that man has power over nature? What is entailed in that kind of power? And the chapter entitled The Conquest of Nature raises this question very specifically. He says, and I quote, "In what sense is man the possessor of increasing power over nature?" And he goes on to say, "What we call man's power is in reality a power possessed by some men which they may or may not allow other men to profit by." What he's saying, of course, is fairly obvious, that when scientists or someone, say, high in the technology world, learns how to control nuclear energy, learns how to make bombs, when people learn how to do all sorts of things technologically, it's not just that human beings generally gain power over nature, it's that the few people who control the science and technology potentially have great power over nature and over other people. Look at the fear that was very pervasive during World War II, that the Nazis would gain nuclear bombs before we did. And part of the impetus to develop nuclear bombs was the terrible fear that Hitler might get them before the United States and Britain got them. Lewis says, for instance, "What we call man's power is in reality a power possessed by some men, which they may or may not allow other men to profit by." He says that bombs represent a certain power over nature, but don't forget, he argues, that we may be on the receiving end when it comes to bombs. Contraceptives, genetic manipulation, selective breeding, mind you, this was all long before DNA. He says all of these give us a certain power over subsequent generations. If you control the genome, you can design human beings in a way that you gain a certain power over what future people will be like. And of course, this is magnified itself many, many fold since Lewis wrote this. He asked us to participate in a thought experiment. He says, let's imagine a generation arising in the future that is able to design the human being of the future through eugenics and scientific indoctrination, psychology, and so on. He says this would represent a certain power over nature, including human nature. And then he writes, he says, in reality, of course, if any one age really attains by eugenics and scientific education, add bioengineering to the mix, the power to make its descendants what it pleases, all men who live after it are the patients of that power. Now, what does he really mean by that? He asks the question, will these human beings of the future be stronger than us? Will they have more power over nature than us, or less? He says, on the contrary, he says, the last men, far from being the heirs of power, will be of all men most subject to the dead hand of the great planners and conditioners. He refers to the planners and conditioners as the people who control the science and the technology. He says, of all people, they will be most subject to the dead hand of the great planners and conditioners and will themselves exercise least power upon the future. He says, the real picture, and I'm quoting him, is that of one dominant age. Let us suppose the 100th century A.D., 10,000 years from now. And notice, today we have writers speculating that something like this could happen within 20, 50, 100 years. The clock has speeded up. Let us imagine, let us suppose the 100th century A.D., that there's one dominant age which resists all previous ages most successfully, and dominates all subsequent ages most irresistibly, and thus is the real master of the human species. But even among this generation, the power will be exercised, he reminds us, by a small minority, namely those who possess political and scientific capability. He refers to the omnicompetent state of the irresistible scientific technique and so on. Then Lewis asks, or adds, I should say, a very, very interesting twist. And this is really what the argument is all about. He says, what if those in power, the scientists and politicians that he calls the conditioners, not only possess great power, but also believe that there is no objective moral truth? Everything is relative and subjective in the realm of morality. It may be true for you, and the opposite may be true for you, and neither true for you. It's all personal decisions. He says, what if among these conditioners, they not only possess this great power, but also believe that there is no objective moral truth, no stable human nature, no rational basis for making decisions about how to use this power in an appropriate manner? That is, what if the conditioners are basically moral subjectivists, moral relativists? What then? Here the argument becomes, or the scenario, I should say, becomes really interesting. Because he says, in this case, the conditioners would be free to do whatever they choose, whatever they please, to design the human being of the future in whatever way they want to. But how will they choose? If they try to improve the human race, what would be their pattern, their standard, their model? If they rejected all traditional concepts of morality and value, if they really act out of their moral relativism or subjectivism, then they will have just one thing left to act on at any given time, their wants and desires and impulses of the moment. But if there's no reliable standard, then how do you even sort out among your desires and impulses? Because they tend to be rather chaotic. It's just one thing after another. And Lewis says this poses then an enormously difficult, odd situation, because here with no moral standard, it's just one impulse after another. It's a totally chancy business. And in one sense, that's the very essence of nature. Animals don't sort out among their impulses. They just have them and act. Humans are the ones who, to some extent, have separated themselves from nature through morality, philosophy, religion, and so on, and begin to talk about justice and about some ways of living as being better than others. And so what Lewis argues here in a very, very fascinating manner is that at this point where humans ought to be the masters of nature, where we ought to have all this glorious future and freedom to live different lives, paradoxically, nature masters us, and indeed, he argues, abolishes us. Because we have no reliable way for sorting out among our impulses and desires. Just one damn thing after another, and no way of arguing that Mother Teresa is any better than Adolf Hitler, or Martin Luther King's vision of life was any better than that of Joseph Stalin, because it's all a subjective, relative morass. And that just as these impulses all come naturally, chaotically, without any moral guidance, returning us, in essence, to the way animals live, nature ends up really abolishing us as human beings, because this gives us the power to destroy what is quintessentially human. That's a fascinating argument. It's a rather scary argument. That we may be in a very, very strange position with this growing scientific, technological, industrial power, and yet no reliable moral standards for guidance about how to use it. Let's take just a few minutes. Give me a little reaction to this. We don't need 15 minutes to sort out the sections. What do you think? Does that argument make any sense to you? What do you think? Yes, nice and loud so everyone can hear.
It seems to be kind of contingent on if these controllers have no moral value.
Exactly.
Who's to say that it's not completely opposite? We breed for morality. We breed Mother Teresa instead of, like, powerful people.
There might be a chance of that.
Well, what's the difference in likelihood of that than what you're talking about?
What do you think? Apart from moral standards, why would we even emulate a Mother Teresa or a St. Francis? It seems to me, if you look at the popular culture today, we have a whole lot of anti-heroes in a way. You know, if you look at some of the heavy metal rock and rap music and some of the movies and so on, television, it would seem like that might happen, but it doesn't seem all that likely to me. I don't know. I'm interested in...
That doesn't seem all that likely
to me
either.
Yeah.
So.
Other, yes?
I mean, the suggestion about morality that isn't really natural, or as far as natural selection is concerned, that morality isn't something that's selected for. But in reality, if you believe in group selection or in sort of cultural selection, that morality is something that would actually be selected for in human nature. It actually allows us to work together better and perhaps over the long term survive, as opposed to having groups of selfish, people running around that eventually destroy the
situation. Okay. Let's come back to that, but here's a comment. Yeah.
I don't think it's such a point about morality, it's so much as what is morality. Like, who's to say this is right and this is wrong? No one can be that absolute. Like, if you were saying about the perfect human being, who's to say it was perfect? No one knows. You've never seen perfect. How can you try to recreate it?
The course is going to really try to answer that question in part, because that's a very, very basic question. Others? Yeah.
I think one of the reasons we say that was because a lot of intellectuals at the time were getting more and more into the more relativism with, stuff that was not as much and more open, more flexible. And I think some of that is pretty strong still, a lot of intellectuals.
It may not be like those people that want to talk to humans, but I think it's a relevant question to ask.
Okay.
And like, what effect does relativism have on how we live our lives?
Okay. Or another question to ask, coming back to the comment here, how relevant is natural selection anymore vis-a-vis human beings? Is it really a very fruitful concept when we can deliberately redesign the DNA and manipulate our genes and so on? Is natural selection very useful any longer in talking about human beings? When we, for whatever reason, good or bad, when we keep people alive with cystic fibrosis and multiple sclerosis and all kinds of birth defects, is natural selection any longer a very fruitful way for understanding human beings? Maybe in part, but that, again, that's the kind of question we may want to reflect on. Any other just offhand reactions? Greg, you look like you have something to say.
I'm just interested to hear these questions. It seems like you raise a lot of questions in this class, and I know that's always one of the goals, to get grappling with that as we've already started doing. It's actually kind of smiling.
Yeah, we may well end up with more questions than we start with, but my hope is that we will begin to see some possible answers and also begin to develop ways of thinking about the questions that really make sense. Incidentally, I might add as a caveat, I may say things at times that seem fairly critical of modern science and technology. But keep that always in perspective. I think that modern science is one of the great human achievements. It's one of the great intellectual endeavors, and I don't think we can live very well today at all without good science and good technology and so on. When I sometimes make comments that impinge on science, I think that question is a settled issue for me. The issue that I'm concerned about is the question of balance. Are we overly preoccupied? Are we intoxicated with power and control and wanting to force our will on everyone and everything? It's not whether science as such is good or bad. I wouldn't fancy much living in this climate, or even less so in northern Saskatchewan through a winter without some way of protecting myself from the elements. I probably wouldn't be alive today without modern science because of some childhood illnesses and so on. So that, keep that in perspective. I'll frequently say things that will refer to or will question our preoccupation with power and control, but not in a way that I'm not a Luddite, I'm not in favor of going back to nature and living, quote, a primitive life. I like the world a lot the way it is. Okay, we'll all of these questions we'll come back to, and the question you asked in back, your comment about who's to say what's right and good and so on.